What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, when a man attacked an Iraqi restaurant in Portland, Oregon, it felt to the owner like an attack on his country, an act of hate. But as details emerged about the man who did it, the story became far more complicated. It's Friday, November 3rd. Dave, describe for me what we see on the surveillance video from this restaurant, Dar Salaam, on the night of April 25th.
It's a busy night at the restaurant, and you can see on the surveillance video that a man with a shaved head walks in with a friend and takes a seat in the middle of the restaurant. People around him are all eating. And he doesn't order. He sits there. He looks around at photos of Iraq that are covering the walls.
Dave Phillips has been reporting on what happened that night.
You see the waiter come up and ask again and again if they can help him.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about a half hour, he and his friend get up, and the man with the shaved head is looking around, trying to leave, maybe a little nervous, his hands jammed in his pockets. And then really without warning, he picks up a chair. You can see him slightly test it for weight, and he swings it as hard as he can into the waiter's head.
Wow.
A customer goes on the attack at an Iraqi restaurant in North Portland.
An employee was hit over the head with a chair.
The owners of Dar Salaam say two men were in the restaurant for about an hour, at times yelling racial slurs at staff, when one seen on the right picks up a chair and hits a waiter so hard it left the server with a bruised shoulder. You can see the melee.
After what happens in the restaurant, right away, Jaith Saheb, the owner of the restaurant, gets a call from his sister saying, you've got to come down, there's been an attack.
I get a phone call from my sister and cry and yelling, screaming to me, Jaith, somebody attacked us.
He rushes down.
I left my car, like, running, you know, the doors open.
In the parking lot?
Yeah, I was really worried. And then when I get close to the restaurant, I say, like, tables are broken, glasses everywhere, police everywhere.
Wow.
And I didn't understand what happened that night.
So Dave, take me through what unfolds after that from a legal perspective.
Well, so what's really tricky is that the man with the shaved head didn't just hit an Iraqi waiter with a chair. He hit an Iraqi waiter with a chair in Portland, Oregon in 2017, right when the city is completely on edge over what it sees as a rise in white nationalism and hate crimes.
Over the weekend, someone spray-painted ISIS on a mosque in North Portland.
Now, students and teachers have found swastikas and other racial slurs written inside the
building. Two men were killed by knife attack on a Portland train Friday after coming to the aid of two women who appeared to be Muslim.
And so they really wanted to make a stand and say, hey, we are Portlandia. We're this really eclectic, creative city. And I think local prosecutors really wanted to show that they weren't going to stand for something like this. And what happens is they increase the charges on him from misdemeanor charges, where he probably would have gotten probation, to a hate crime, essentially a bias-related crime and felony-level assault.
My experience, 8 years or 9 years in Portland, we didn't have this kind of things. And I really be honest with you, this guy, what he did, brings so much memory to me and to my family. And I don't know, I really, after the incident happens, Alton, now really I don't feel safe again.
The owner of the restaurant, what happened really unnerves him, because basically what he had been running away from for years had suddenly come right into the middle of his life again.
I grew up and raised in Baghdad. Always we hear about war.
So he had been a middle-class kid, a college kid actually, going to business school in Baghdad when the Iraq War started.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people.
Baghdad tonight, under heavy bombardment on the day the war started. American and British troops are in action on land, sea, and in the air.
And he was actually kind of excited about the U.S. invasion because he thought it would be liberation. He thought that lives would get better for everyone, and so did his family. But they quickly realized that it didn't. Order melted away. There was no authority to replace the Ba'athists that had been driven out. And so very quickly, it turned into first looting and then killing.
You see things you don't want to see it, like armies and shooting and killing, kidnapping, bombing. Weekly, you know, we hear this kind of news. And even the day when I want to go, like, to the college or do something or go to work, and always I hug my mom, I hug my dad, say, you know, pray for me. I don't know if I'll see you again or not.
So piece by piece, the Sahib family's life starts falling apart, and they have to move from their neighborhood and their jobs disappear, but they're trying to hold it together. Jaith is still going to school. They're still living in Baghdad until this one day when he's on his way to class and everything for him falls apart.
My college is far from my home, about like 15 minutes drive. So, you know, I left home and I had the breakfast and I want to go to the college. And then when I was driving, I was very close, like 5 minutes far away from the college. And then just, I saw like lighting and big exploding and noise everywhere. And then after that, I don't know what happened. 3 weeks later, I found out I was in the car bomb.
Wow.
When I wake from the coma after 3 weeks, I can't eat, I can't talk. I was very skinny. After I left the hospital, it takes me about 2 months, I was just home.
He falls into this depression where he doesn't want to leave the house. He doesn't know what to do with his life. He's both fearful and filled with, I guess, dread, you know, that there's nothing left for him anymore.
I just feel like really I don't want to live again.
And I think in a big way, that's why he felt he had to leave Iraq, is that everything in Iraq was traumatic to him. It all reminded him of the loss and the death that he'd experienced.
I left Iraq and went to Syria. And after Syria, I went to India, and after India, I went to Europe.
Jaith leaves Iraq, assuming he'll never come back, and he goes to, I think, six countries, and accidentally meets his wife, who is from a place that he's never heard of, Portland, Oregon. And they get married and move to the United States together. I think that the United States is probably one of the last places that Jaith wanted to end up, because he was kind of afraid of it. The United States had invaded his country. And so when he ended up here, I think he thought that Americans were much different, much more pro-war, much more anti-Iraq.
That time somebody asked me where you're from. I say from Middle East, and I don't mention from Iraq. And they asked me, okay, where in Middle East? And I don't answer this question. I'm not just Middle East.
And so at first, he was very hesitant to even say that he was Iraqi.
And then it takes time. And then after 6 months, 7 months, start more open, you know, for people. And I start, you know, talk about Iraq. And I saw people accept that from me. And they start asking me questions about my family. And, you know, so I start feel really welcome here. And the story starts from there. So
it's an exotic flavor you don't find very often in the States. And the family behind the counter is just as unique as the dishes they serve.
Jaith Sahab stands next to his mother, cooking up some of their favorite dishes.
So in the beginning, it was hard, but I was having really joy working, you know.
Now, you guys.
Now it's really good.
Good.
Their restaurant is an old carriage house, and they've completely redecorated it. It's very brightly painted, yellow and red walls, and they've covered all of the walls with different photographs, photographs of Baghdad during the war, but also ancient art, paintings. It's basically like a showcase for a scrapbook of Iraqi culture.
So I just kind of try to, you know, educate people about Iraq and the culture too. And I feel like confusing because I left 2006 because I don't like my country anymore, but still some part of me is missing it. Always when I come to the restaurant, I feel like I'm going to really to Iraq. Yeah.
Right. That you've created a part of Iraq in your restaurant, but it's on your own terms and it's peaceful.
Exactly, yes.
Hmm.
The name of the restaurant called Dar al-Salam. It's Arabic word, and in English it means the house of peace.
The house of peace.
Yes.
And then on a busy night, this guy with a shaved head walks in, takes a seat against the wall, and after a couple minutes, attacks one of his waiters. And I think that having this man with a shaved head come into the restaurant and do something like this really brought the war back mm-hmm. in this vivid way for him that really unsettled him much more than just a simple assault would.
From that night, I don't feel safe anymore. Like before, I like to walk, you know, at night, you know, sometime, you know, close to my business, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel safe, like I can, but now I don't feel safe anymore. I feel scared, like maybe I will get hit, somebody will attack me, always, you know.
You're looking over your shoulder.
Exactly, yes, yes, really, that's exactly what I feel.
It brought the war back and raised the question for him that he might never be able to get away from it.
I just want to find the reason why he did this to my employee and to my sister and to my customer. I just want to find the answer.
So that's where it gets kind of interesting. The man, you know, he's wearing a hoodie, he's muscular, he's got a shaved head. I think a lot of people at the restaurant might have thought that he was some skinhead, essentially. In fact, he's a career sergeant major in the United States Marine Corps, a 40-year-old guy named Damian Rodriguez, who had done four deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's what really caught my attention. Here's this guy with this long history of exposure to combat coming into an Iraqi restaurant and attacking the waiter. To what extent was this a hate crime and to what extent was it a wound of war?
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for the New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
After I saw the news that this Marine Sergeant Major had attacked the restaurant, I started calling around because I wanted to know not what had happened that night, that had already been covered, but what had happened in his life in all the years leading up to it.
All right. My name is Robbie Bellow.
and I'm the mother of Sergeant Major Damian Rodriguez.
I want to ask you just about Damian as a young kid. Just give me a feeling for kind of for Damian himself as a young boy.
All right, this is kind of weird. But when they were very little, I played Perry Como songs.
Magic moments when two hearts are kept.
My mother was a voice teacher, so we were always trying to get Damian to sing. And he just hated that. He didn't want to sing in front of anybody. And then one time he said, okay, to please grandma or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we couldn't get him to stop. It was so funny. He kept on singing. Then the other thing that always struck me was that my dad being from World War II, it was very important to put the flag out on holidays. Mm-hmm. And Damian was so excited to do the salute and stand with my dad. And he would always try to dress up very formal. He started dressing up as a Marine when he was 8 years old.
Wow.
He put the black stuff on his face that they put on so you're not seen in the dark.
And like under his eyes?
Yeah. And of course, every Halloween, he was dressed up as a Marine.
I think if you asked him who he was and to describe himself, he would just say that he was a Marine. He tried to sign up even before he was old enough. And then he got his GED so that he could enlist earlier and didn't have to finish high school. I think it's the place where he found himself. You know, he enjoyed the challenge and the mission and serving his country and talking to people who served with him. They, across the board, loved him.
He was our platoon sergeant, so he was in charge of all of us.
Jimmy Gentile served under Rodriguez in the Marines.
You know, I look back on it, it's more like he was babysitting a lot of us because we were all so young. But, you know.
How young were you?
I was 20, and then we had guys in the platoon that were 17, 18 years old.
He did 4 combat tours, 2 in Iraq. But really what stuck with him, what he was never able to move beyond, was a single day back in his first tour in Ramadi, Iraq.
Oh, yes. This is March 16th of 2004. And this is handwritten just before things happened.
Mm-hmm.
So he said to the family, how's everyone doing? I'm doing pretty good. Sorry I haven't written sooner, but it's been real busy. Kuwait was boring, but here in our Ramadi, I'm trying to read his writing, it's a different story. It's a city with a lot of bad guys that are already out and about.
So this is right when the war in Iraq is starting to come off the wheels, when American troops are starting to realize that the insurgency is something bigger and more organized than they thought.
And so we're doing a lot more patrols now than we did before. Yesterday on patrol, we had about 100 kids following us. Well, things are going good. I just wish I could have a beer. Right back. Love, Damian. This is about a week before everything happened.
And on a spring day, April 6th, 2004, Damian Rodriguez takes a squad of about a dozen Marines out on a foot patrol.
So we set out from the combat outpost. As we're moving through and leaving, we realized these streets that normally have kids throwing rocks at us were very empty. And this is about 11 a.m., something like that.
So that's strange.
Yeah, very strange. You always hear veterans, Vietnam vets, people like that say, you know it's going to be bad when it's quiet.
What he didn't know is that there was this vast coordinated attack by insurgents about to happen citywide. And they round a corner walking down the sidewalk of an urban boulevard and fire just erupts from everywhere.
They opened up on us in a 360-degree ambush.
Windows, rooftops, alleys.
I can feel the rounds cracking around me. I can feel in here. I can feel the air. I can feel them. I can see them hitting all around me. I felt and heard a really loud pop and then a very warm feeling all over my face because I was shot in the face right behind my right ear. It severed the external carotid artery. I should have been dead immediately. It was pouring blood out.
Rodriguez takes the guys that he can get together and he holes up in a house and sort of tries to take stock. He's got two Marines already dead in the street, and he can't get to the bodies because there's too much fire going on. Remember, he's in charge, but at the same time, there's not a whole lot he can do. Hmm. They're running low on ammo. He's got his hand pressed against the neck of another private who has been shot through the neck. And really all he can do is keep shooting.
He was cracking jokes with me, just trying to help me stay calm, which I was.
What kind of joke could anyone, let alone your platoon leader, make at that moment to make you feel better when you've been shot in the face and you're bleeding like that?
Well, there was a couple of them. One of it was just, hey, you're going to be in Germany in no time hanging out with the nurses. What are you complaining about? You know, just give me a hard time. And then they used to joke with me that I had a big nose, and they said, hey, you just took a little bit off the tip, you know, stuff like that, off the nose. And so
over the radio comes a report that the other group that was split off by them has just been hit by a grenade, and they've got two guys down. They're still taking fire. He's called for reinforcements, but they can't get there because the whole city is essentially a repeat of this whole scene. There's fighting going on all over the place.
We finally were medevaced out of there, or I was. They showed up in the Humvees, and he looked back at me and said, can you walk? And I gave him a thumbs up. Ran out there. He helped me get in the Humvee. Marines are killed. We've lost some of our friends, our brothers. There wasn't much of us left.
Hi, Mom. Well, as you know, we're out of the city and sort of in a safe place. My platoon and I have just been relaxing, eating, and exercising. We've also been going to a lot of post-traumatic stress classes with the chaplain. It's one of those mandatory things. But it's good, since my platoon have been through a lot of stuff. Keep up the prayers for us, and we should be home safe and sound. I look forward to seeing you. Love, Damien.
Were you, when you got that note, Robbie, and he mentioned PTSD and what he and his fellow Marines had been through, were you worried about him?
Oh, definitely. We were all worried. We knew from the minute he came home, because his eyes were, I wouldn't say they're empty, but his eyes had changed.
How?
When I looked into his eyes, there was just this, like, emptiness, just his body language, and his spirit had been crushed. That's how it felt.
Everyone I talked to sort of said the same thing, that after that first 2004 deployment, he was never really the same. He came home sullen. He started drinking a lot more. He became obsessed isn't the right word, but consumed with the deaths of the men that had served under him.
Yeah, I mean, every time we get together, he talks, he wants to talk through it. He wants to go through from the beginning of the patrol to all the way through it. He's sad. I think he's sad a lot. He's hurting. He was the platoon sergeant. He was in charge, and his Marines were killed and seriously wounded. And he thinks about it constantly. That's the way it changes you, because it's never not on your mind.
When I first tried to talk to him about this, I flew out to his house. He lives near San Diego, and he had agreed to talk to me. But this is something that is still so painful to him more than a decade later that he couldn't bring himself to come to the door. A few weeks later, after I think I gained a little more trust with him, he tried again. We got on the phone, and I asked him to take me back and just walk me through that scene from when the shooting started on the street. And he tried. He really tried. And he would start and pause and start and pause. And then he just started crying, and he apologized, and he said he couldn't do it. I think that those images of seeing his Marines killed, being in charge, and not being able to do anything until it was too late have never left him. But there's a lot that he doesn't remember. He has a citation, a Bronze Star citation for valor, that says that he killed 10 people that day. And I asked him about that, and he said he couldn't remember it all clearly. Hmm. And I know that the fact that there are people he killed that he can't really remember deeply bothers him. You know, that something so significant is kind of a blur. And you spend years trying to sort it out when it's not even clear in your mind and your memory what took place.
Was he ever officially diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder?
After a couple of years, he was. He first started getting treated for what I think is pretty clearly typical symptoms of PTSD back in 2005 and in 2006 and in 2007. He wasn't diagnosed until 2009. And even then, I believe he kept it really quiet. There were treatments that were open to Marines, inpatient or intensive treatments where you could really sort of step aside and deal with this stuff. And he chose not to do them because he was so afraid that if he did, his career was over.
Hmm.
And when I say career, it's not just a career for a Marine like this. It's your entire life and identity. It would have been taking everything that he thought he was and was most proud of and throwing it away.
So what kinds of things would put Damien on edge?
So this is really typical for anyone with this kind of war injury. They are hyper alert. If they go into an uncertain situation, it can be extremely uncomfortable for them. So like the typical thing is a restaurant. You're in a room full of people you don't know. Your back is to half of them. And that can sort of ratchet up this sort of fear response. And that was really typical for him for years after he got back from Iraq. And in fact, he would try to sit in a corner with his back to the wall if he could. And in fact, in the surveillance video at the Iraqi restaurant, what you see is that he's initially seated at a table in the middle of the room because it's busy. But as soon as a table opens up on the side of the room, he and his friend move over and he puts his back against the wall.
Can you bring me up to the day of the alleged crime? What was Damien doing in Portland at that moment, and what was going on in his life?
He had just been given a new assignment. It was going to be his last before he planned to retire. He was taking over a little reserve unit in Portland. And after they had a little ceremony where he took command, he went out and celebrated. He went out with a Marine who he knew who lived in the area, and they went to go to a bar on this artsy little street called Alberta Street up in northeast Portland. And what's significant about this is that it's April, and April is the time when he is still dealing with the memories, the anniversary of this firefight that he hasn't gotten over. They go out drinking, and they're actually on their way home from the bar when they walk past this Iraqi restaurant. And both of them say, huh, we're kind of hungry. Iraq, that might be kind of cool. Let's go in and get something to eat.
Surveillance video shows a man swinging a chair, attacking staff inside an Iraqi restaurant in northeast Portland.
Turns out the man arrested and charged in this case is a U.S. Marine and Iraq war veteran.
I guess the biggest problem with trying to deal with cases like this fairly is you never really know what was happening inside someone's head. Was he having a flashback, or was he just angry over everything in his past and decided to hit somebody with a chair? I can't honestly say.
Yeah, it's pain is what that day was, that night. Pain and alcohol. You can't take that one night and judge a man based off of that one night. It was a dumb mistake, sure, and he has to pay his consequences. I think they're being a little severe, if you're asking my opinion, but being a little is an understatement. But he's, you know, he made a mistake. He's paying for that mistake right now. And but do I think that he feels negatively towards Iraqis? No. We were there to, we gave our lives for that country. We gave our heart, our soul, everything for those people.
The friends and family of this Marine would say that he did what he did in the restaurant, they would say that he did that because of the trauma that he experienced. What do you think about that explanation?
Well, I don't know him as a person, but I hear him. I've been through the same. My family been through the same. Most of Iraqi people been the same. Most of the American soldier, Marines, they've been the same. So we share. But this is not something allowed me to go and, you know, and hit chairs, you know, for people I don't like. It doesn't work this way.
But you're saying you were both traumatized by the same war.
Yes. I feel like really he need help. I want people to learn from the mistake. And if he said he did mistake and he did bad things and he will learn from it, I will forgive him. I really don't have any problem with him. And I wish all the best really for him. And I feel if he can get help from his community, from his family, you know, and he learned about the forgiveness, and I think that should be the best way to make, you know, to make the world even more peaceful this way.
Do you think that what he did was a hate crime?
I don't know. I feel sorry for him, believe me, you know, and I feel sorry for myself too. It doesn't have to be like this. It really doesn't have to be like this. Hopefully he can get help.
Dave, I would have imagined that the criminal justice system would account in some way for veterans. But here we're talking about Damien being charged with a hate crime.
Well, so all over the country, we've set up hundreds of what they call veterans treatment courts. The idea being if you get in trouble with the law and it has something to do with PTSD, we're going to give you a second chance. Instead of putting you behind bars, we're going to make sure that you get treatment. Because if we can straighten you out, you're good to go. And we want to help you since, you know, you raised your hand and you served, you know, in the country's military.
So Damien could be tried in one of these courts.
Well, that's the catch-22, is almost all of these courts won't allow veterans who are charged with a violent crime. Drug abuse, you bet. Petty theft, sure. But putting a gun to someone's head or hitting somebody with a chair, well, then that gets into this really tough space of, okay, how much do we give understanding and treatment to this person? And how much do we owe to the victim that's been harmed, you know? And that's what we haven't worked out as a society. You know, a lot of people have said to me, okay, so what? This guy was traumatized in Iraq. Think of all the people that are traumatized by a upbringing in a bad neighborhood or parents who are addicted to drugs. They don't get a special deal when they go into the criminal justice system. But I think it's really different because here's a person who's been injured by our federal policy, injured because they volunteered to do something very dangerous that at least ostensibly at the time was in the national interest. I think the government has to address fairly the injuries for these guys. And what it's struggling with now is, how do you do that when the injury means a crime?
You know, killing people and having people, your brothers killed right next to you or in front of you, there's no file in your brain to put that. But then you're trained to do this. But then it's like, well, where do you put this? How do I put this somewhere in my mind, in my emotions? But then the emotions of the moment and what he experienced and breathed and saw, that kept coming up. That's still there with him. That doesn't go away. You have to learn how to deal with it. But that's the hard part.
Retired Sergeant Major Damien Rodriguez is scheduled for trial in December in Multnomah County Court. He's charged with felony-level assault and intimidation, Oregon's equivalent of a hate crime. If convicted, he faces a mandatory prison sentence. The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Lindsay Garrison, Rachel Quester, Annie Brown, Andy Mills, Christopher Worth, Ike Sriskantharaja, and Claire Tennisketter, with editing help from Larissa Anderson. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Brad Fisher is our technical manager. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to Peter Sale, Sam Dolnick, and Michaela Bouchard. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. My colleague Sabrina Tavernisi will be hosting on Monday.